Running a business is hard enough. Don't make it harder with a dozen apps that don't talk to each other. One for sales, another for inventory, a separate one for accounting. That's software overload. Odoo is the all-in-one platform that replaces them all. CRM, accounting, inventory, e-commerce, HR. Fully integrated, easy to use, and built to grow with your business. Thousands have already made the switch. Why not you? Try Odoo for free at odoo.com. That's odoo.com.
There's nothing like sinking into luxury. Anabe sofas combine ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. Anabe has designed the only fully machine washable sofa from top to bottom. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash. Perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your home. Sofas start at just $699. And right now, get early access to Black Friday savings, up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Sky Warriors, British Airborne Forces in the Second World War, from best-selling historian Saul David. It's a riveting history of the British Airborne experience across the Second World War. It's about the legendary Red Devils, among the finest combat troops of the Second World War. Delighted to say that joining me live on the line from probably an aircraft hangar somewhere preparing to go off in a glider, Saul David himself. Saul, good morning to you.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure's all mine. The Red Devils, a name that strikes terror into the hearts. I mean, if you grew up like I did with comics like, you know, Battle and Commando, the Red Devils were an integral part of it. And you know, it would strike fear into the hearts of any sort of German or Axis troop. And we tend to think that they sort of sprung fully formed from the air. But the story's an awful lot more interesting than that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long and winding road, really, for them to get to what I'd call probably the apogee, which is when they were fighting at D-Day. Arnhem doesn't go so well immediately after that, but the final operation of the Second World War, Varsity, is a great success, and they really learned a lot of the lessons from previous errors that they've made. But if you think of the scale of those operations, you're talking about 8 to 10,000 guys coming out of the air, both in parachutes and gliders. If you go all the way back to the beginning of the Second World War, when they started, and you know, it's worth reminding listeners that Britain didn't have an airborne capability at the beginning of the Second World War. The Russians did, the Italians did, the Germans did, and quite a few other countries did, but not the Brits. We really tended to see planes as a way of bringing in supplies and you know, and possibly landing troops, but not dropping them from the air. So it all happened in a big hurry, and it was mainly the job of Churchill to encourage this, because he felt after Dunkirk, when our backs really were against the wall, we needed a weapon to fight back. He set up the commandos, and a bit of the commandos was parachute capable. Churchill actually asked for 5,000 troops, but it took an awful long time to get those guys ready and willing to fight. So you've got a long and involved story. And it's interesting, in the early days, they carried out raids, sometimes successfully, sometimes not so successfully. In North Africa, they really fought mainly as traditional infantry, but it was only by 43 onwards that they begin to operate in this, what I'd describe as this kind of strategic role.
I'm just trying to think, because if they're sort of setting themselves up in North Africa, then of course, Crete, I mean, I might get my time wrong, completely wrong, but the Fallschirmjäger, you see, I've been listening to James Holland, you see, the Fallschirmjäger come along, and that really puts the willies at everybody, because they go, hang on a second, I mean, you can debate whether the Crete was worth it, but it certainly was a great PR exercise for having airborne troops.
Yeah, it's fascinating, actually, Crete, because it does two things. It basically puts the nail into the coffin of German airborne, because they're never used on a major scale again. One of the reasons why is that so many of them get killed. You're very vulnerable coming down in a parachute. You know, I think it goes without saying. The best way to parachute, or the best time to parachute, is at night when you can't be seen. But most of the Cree parachuters came down during the day. They could be easily seen, and a lot of them were killed, up to 4,000. So the Germans really say, in fact, Hitler himself says, no more major airborne operations. But the Brits think the other way. They actually think, well, the loss of Crete to an airborne operation, it was partly air, partly sea, and partly air landing, is evidence, actually, that airborne really can make a difference. So it's fortunate we thought that, in truth, because later on in the war, particularly in 44, I already mentioned D-Day, Varsity in 45, they really do play a massively important role. And what you can do with airborne is you can drop them behind enemy lines. But the trick is not to have them so far away from the ground troops coming in support that they effectively get marooned, which is what happens at Arnhem. But D-Day, it works beautifully because they are landed on the eastern side of the beachhead. And that's the most vulnerable one. And it's interesting that was given to the British paratroopers, or the British airborne, and not US airborne. US airborne were at the far side, but the western flank wasn't as dangerous because it wasn't as open. The eastern flank, which is where the Brits were, that's protecting Sword Beach, the left flank, as I say, of the landing beaches. And that's where, of course, all the German strength is, their strategic reserve, particularly the Panzer division. So it had a vital job to do, and that's to act as a bulwark until all those guys can actually get safely onto the beach. So that crucial first night, the 5th and 6th of June, was absolutely fundamental to the success of D-Day. And that's where airborne really proved their worth.
And there's a point as well in airborne which is disbanded shortly afterwards, which is gliders. They always kind of get a bit overlooked. But if you taking the taking the bridges, at Pegasus, not only were troops going in on out of parachutes, but they were coming in on big gliders with Royal Engineers, combat engineers, Bailey bridges ready, or big construction materials should the bridges be blown, etc. All the stuff you needed, and you could do that in a glider, which you couldn't do. You can try throwing a tank out the back of a Dakota, but it won't end very well.
Well, that's why gliders were such an integral part. Of course, they're ultimately replaced, and so are parachutes, in a sense, by helicopters, which can bring in, heavy lift. They can bring in, but of course, in the Second World War, they didn't have that. So, you drop by a parachute, you're gonna be thrown all over the place. And it's really interesting that the American airborne on D-Day, only 1/6, that's 1 in 6 of the guys they drop, actually lands anywhere near where they intend them to be. So, gliders are much more effective at bringing in a lot of people with heavier kits in the right place at the right time. So, they're often used for coup de main, which is the sudden strike to capture a bridge or an important location. It's also incredibly dangerous, though. I mean, there's an instance when they're trying to capture a bridge in Sicily where one of the two gliders goes in and it just explodes. Every single person on it killed because of the munitions they're bringing in to blow their way into this particular location. So very dangerous. And even the famous Pegasus Bridge operation, John Howard, who's a wonderful character, who's comes from a ridiculously modest background for, an army officer of the Second World War, born in a 2-up, 2-down house in Camden, North London, leaves school at 14. Anyway, he works his way up to this position of commanding the vanguard of the whole of D-Day. And when his glider, number one glider, lands 50 yards away from Pegasus Bridge, he's knocked unconscious, as indeed a lot of the people on gliders were, because of the shock of landing. I mean, it's you effectively crash landing. It's a mad way to go to war. But then again, a parachute's a pretty mad way. So you can imagine the sort of character of the people who tended to join airborne then and still today, to be truthful. I mean, really, they all had to be volunteers. They're given an extra 2 shillings a day, which wasn't really enough in my view. But joking aside, incredibly brave men, resourceful, psychologically had to be very self-contained because you're often fighting complete isolation with relatively light weapons. I mean, it's a hell of a job to do, but Howard was wonderful and he trained his men absolutely to the max and they pulled it off.
So Churchill goes, right, we need this. Is this a bit sort of like, what is it, set Europe alight, but we need some Red Devils as well. So is it Howard the person, because, okay, go away and, I mean, it's a bit like, it's a bit like SS, isn't it? Go away and put it together over lunch sort of thing on the back of a napkin. So is it the same sort of thing? Because it's literally people thinking out of the box and we've got nothing to lose, so we might as well go for it.com.
Yeah, he was a great ideas man, Churchill. You know, he'd come up with these kind of grand phrases, and you see all these documents, you know, literally the documents which he called for 5,000 paratroops. No idea how they're it's actually going to be put together. No idea how they're going to be delivered. I mean, they had no planes that were suitable for dropping paratroopers. They didn't really have a glider that had been developed. All of these things have to get going. And meanwhile, you've got inter-service rivalry. The RAF doesn't want to devote all its planes for dropping parachutists because it believes in strategic bombing. The army, who are really in charge of airborne, you know, is trying to get resources from the RAF. So there are all these reasons why all the different services aren't actually natural supporters of airborne. And probably the reason they survive is, well, a number of, you know, wonderful characters who play a key role in the early years. Lewis Strange, John Rock, even Frederick Boy Browning, actually, who gets a bit of a bad rep because he doesn't... he hasn't done well at Arnhem ultimately, but he's a great supporter in the early days of getting airborne up and running. But the most important person of all is, of course, Churchill. And he never forgets that he's given this initial order. And he keeps going back to his RAF chiefs and his army chiefs saying, well, what's going on? And so slowly but surely, he insists that resources are devoted for what some people in the traditional services would see as a waste of money, but ultimately it wasn't. You realize, you know, by 1944, actually airborne has a really important role to play. One quick point about the Germans. I mean, they, as the war went on, of course, they're losing air superiority. They, you know, in North Africa, really against the Western allies, is probably the last time they have it. And thereafter, they're up against it. And of course, if you don't have control of the air, inserting airborne troops is incredibly dangerous. So that's another reason why they effectively wrapped up those operations. They're full Schirmjägers, though, as you pointed out, incredibly effective fighting on the ground. They didn't need to be dropped from the air. So, you know, they defend famously Monte Cassino and loads of other places. I mean, they're fighting in the D-Day campaign and of course, all the way back into Germany.
So where does the nickname come from, Red Devils? Is this something that the Germans put up, or is this a bit of spin from the Airborne's PR department?
Well, it's funny because I've recently written a book called Devil Dogs, which is the name apparently given to US Marines by Germans in the First World War. And, you know, because they're tremendously ferocious fighters and they were so proud of this that they use Devil Dogs to this day. US Marines still use it. But I, when I wrote that book, I couldn't find a single source that actually confirmed that the Germans had ever said that. It seemed to be PR spin from the Marine Corps. And I'm afraid I'm beginning to come to the same conclusion with Red Devils. I mean, not everyone's going to want to hear this. It's still used proudly today, as you know, by the parachute regiment. But again, there are no documents that actually confirm that. What we do have is General Alexander, who was the commander in chief in North Africa at the end of the campaign in 1943, saying, you know, the Germans have actually used this expression, you know, in admiration of the fighting qualities of the paratroopers. And they do tremendously well in North Africa, fighting as traditional infantry. But there is no source from the German side to suggest that. So we don't know for sure if the Germans said it, but there is no doubt that they were impressed by the fighting qualities of airborne.
So tell us about Varsity, because that is the big success story. I know it's at the end of the war, but as you said, you've got air superiority, so you're not going to get some little Fokker coming around. I said Fokker at the back, be quiet. So therefore, it's a much easier to plan, and perhaps they haven't gone off, because there's so much stuff coming out about Arnhem, and, you know, and as we know, a certain well-known podcast is halfway through his book as well. We're looking forward to that one about Operation Market Garden. But, you know, Market Garden, it goes off sort of half-cut, doesn't it? It doesn't work how it should do. The waves don't go at the same time, and it's a bit of a massive muck-up. Varsity,
they're a victim. Yeah, it's really interesting. They're victims of their own success. There are two points to make about Arnhem. I mean, first of all, D-Day's gone really well and has already proved the worth of airborne in a massive sense, in a divisional sense. Well, of course, you've got the Americans there too. So three divisions used in D-Day, and they all carry out their missions successfully, and it's job done. So they're looking to use them again. And there are something like 15 or 16 operations between D-Day and Arnhem that are cancelled. So on the one hand, you've got the military chiefs thinking we can use these these guys again and very successfully, including Monty, who's not normally, you know, he's normally a bit risk averse, but even he's beginning to think they could be a game changer. And on the other hand, you've got the guys who didn't go in at D-Day, which is First Airborne Division, without getting too much into the detail. You've got two airborne divisions. First Airborne Division is the originals, and they see themselves as the best, although they've been badly cut up in North Africa and Sicily. And you've got Sixth Airborne, who fight for the first time at D-Day and do tremendously well. So First Airborne are determined that they're going to do their bit, that they're going to prove their worth. So they are pushing for operations. The commanders are thinking they can do operations. And the truth about Arnhem is they bit off more than they could chew. Lots of errors made. You know, all of the stories about the intelligence not spotting the German panzer divisions, that's all well known and it's all well recorded. But the conclusion I came to is, despite all of that and despite the pretty much everything going against that operation being successful, they still almost pull it off. I mean, the ground forces, if they got to Nijmegen 12 hours earlier, got across the bridge at Nijmegen 12 hours earlier, which was the last obstacle before you get to the Lower Rhine at Arnhem, then they could have relieved the bridges. And John Frost, who's been there from the start of Airborne, he was there, you know, started out in 41. First operation, famous Operation Biting in 1942, capture of German radar. And he goes all the way through the story. Finally at Arnhem, he's given the main job, hold the bridge. And he does for 4 days, well, almost 4 days. And he's asked to hold it for two. So yes, it was slightly mad, but I don't believe anything is predestined. It was not an operation that was bound to fail. Yes, it had a lot of obstacles, but the sheer tenacity, ingenuity and determination of the Paris fighting at Arnhem, the reason why thereafter Monty said, you know, every man who fought there, it will be proud to say I fought at Arnhem, almost pulled it off. So it's an extraordinary story. And they learned the lessons of Arnhem and they made sure that in Operation Varsity, you reduce the distance between where you drop your guys and where the ground troops have to come from in the first place. You make sure they all go in one lift. That is, you drop them all together and not in a series of staggered lifts, which obviously dilutes their fighting capacity. And you make sure that basically it's a timing issue. And they solved a lot of those problems by Varsity, which really was the sort of crown and glory, I think, of British Airborne.
And Varsity was, I mean, for those who haven't heard of Varsity, it was, yeah, it was what, taking
crossing.
Yes.
Yeah, sorry, I should have been a bit more specific. It's the crossing of the Rhine. So the last major obstacle before the Western Allies get into Germany is the Rhine River, of course. And they've got a little bridgehead, actually, at Rijmegen, which was a sort of coup de main. It's kind of fortunate operation, actually. Interesting battle. So the Americans are over there in a certain amount of force, but the Brits and the Canadians want to cross further to the north. That's Monty. Monty, of course, is competing with Patton as indeed he had been when he launched the Arnhem operation. He's still determined that he's going to play the major role in the defeat of Germany as far as the Western Allies are concerned. And it is a brilliantly planned operation. Two bits to it, Varsity, which is airborne, and Plunder, which is the amphibious crossing. And it goes like clockwork, pretty much. Having said all of that, the airborne do still take a lot of casualties. And that just, I'm afraid, is the nature of the beast. And we move more recently, Hostomel in Ukraine, where Russian airborne try a similar sort of, you know, coup de main operation, doesn't go very well because, again, you've got this kind of disconnect between dropping people in airborne and their support on the ground. You know, too big a gap between the two. So, you know, these lessons still need, there is still a role for airborne today, but you need to learn the lessons that were relevant even in the Second World War.
And you need to jump at night as well and not, you know, and don't underestimate the enemy as well. Because they're a bit over, oh, look up there. What's that? What's up there?
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, two very vulnerable. They're coming. It's interesting when you think between the two, para boy, as I've just for shorthand in my book, I call them glider lads and para boys. And it's interesting that they neither of them wanted to be part of the other. They all thought the other lot were mad. So why would we want to prang into action, as the parachutist said? And the others said, you know, why do we want to be, you know, suspended from a kind of flimsy silk canopy, completely vulnerable as we sort of drift down towards the enemy. And you can see from both perspectives, can't you?
So when it comes to writing something this, I mean, the thing that always distinguishes is the story, isn't it? It's the people, it's the first-hand account. So this is what your book does. I mean, where did you get the background? I mean, I know you know your stuff, Saul, but I mean, to put a fresh spin on it, as it were.
Yeah, well, it's new to me, to be truthful. I mean, of course, the basic beats of the Second World War are new to me. And I've written, you know, many books that have sort of covered a lot of these events, including D-Day, of course. But airborne is a particular branch with a particular type of job. It was, as I've explained, it was long and involved. The way it finally worked out, the most effective way to use airborne, there was always opposition. They had Churchill backing them. But when you write a book like this, you can get all the official documents you like, and they're all out there, you know, waiting for anyone to go and research them at the National Archives and other places. But in the end, it's the anecdotes that work, in my view, because it allows you as a modern reader and me as a historian to kind of transport myself back there and imagine what it must have been like. So someone describing parachuting into Normandy on D-Day, I mean, it's incredibly sort of moving and visceral experience, because they didn't know what was going to happen next. And if I tell you that Ike, that is Eisenhower, the commander-in-chief, had already written a press release basically saying, you know, I'm so sorry, it didn't quite work out. We'll do our best. We'll try again. And we'll give you an indication that, you know, even the senior commanders didn't know that D-Day was going to be a success. So if you are the first guys to go in your gliders and your paratroopers, it's incredibly sort of moving experience. So to have that accounts like that in the book is what is and is tremendously important. You get them all over the place, is the truth of the matter. I mean, you get them in all the obvious places, which is the, you know, the Airborne Museum. They've got a lot of first-hand accounts there. But there are little nuggets all over the place. And one of the beauties of social media, I have to say, these days, and also doing a podcast, is that when I talk in advance about what I'm up to, people then contact me. I literally, about 6 months ago, before the book was complete and I added some of this material, someone said, oh, I've got some, you know, some diaries, some pictures, you know, my ancestor was involved. So all the places that we would normally go to research, including America, where there's some wonderful airborne stuff because of the Cornelius Ryan book. He did a lot of interviews with British Airborne for the longest day, and of course for his Bridge Too Far book. All of those original transcripts are available in the US, but in Britain, of course, there are still private collections. People still got their diaries and letters. So, yeah, whenever I start work on a new subject, I'll try and use material that comes from familiar sources but hasn't been seen before, but also I'll try and dig out some new stuff. And if you're determined enough, you're always going to find some good bits.
And here we are in the 80th anniversary year of D-Day. So there's bound to be going, I mean, there's always going to be interest, but this year especially, because there are so few still around. But also, hopefully, we'll see some more, because there is more and more stuff coming out. People can't say, oh, the Second World War is a closed book, why do you bother with it? But there is more and more fascinating stuff coming out all the time.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And you know, the other important point to remember about, I mean, Second World War is not going to suddenly fade in popularity because the last of the veterans has died, for the very good reason that it is still the sort of, you know, in terms of its scale, it's the greatest conflict that's ever been in human history. And arguably, you know, I mean, we never say never, but arguably that's going to be an accolade that's not taken away from it. And that's the first point. The second point is that pretty much a lot of geopolitical stuff now has it, you know, you can trace it, its roots, or at least you can understand it much better through the context of the Second World War. So what's going on, for example, in Ukraine and Russia, you know, big links to the Second World War, you know, lots and lots of comparisons we're making on the podcast that I do with Patrick Bishop, another historian, but also more recently, a war reporter. And so the memory is not going to die anytime soon. It's not going to fade anytime soon, I don't think, about the Second World War.
The war, the Ukraine, is that battlefield, isn't it? The war, the Ukraine.
Yeah, battleground podcast, yeah.
Indeed. What do you hope the people will take from Sky Warriors?
Well, I mean, I think you hope that they'll take, I mean, I hope they'll take two things, actually. I hope that the stories are going to, you know, make people think, crikey, okay, this was a time when our nation was, you know, at serious risk of being overrun. Everything changing in our lives as you know, members of the, as inhabitants of the United Kingdom. And enough people were prepared to front up, like of course they are doing in Ukraine, to make sure that, you know, the invader, the aggressor, was repelled. Now, the airborne are a particular breed. You know, they're the sort of most gung-ho, the most aggressive, the most highly trained, and as a result, the ones who take the biggest casualties. But I hope people will read it and think, crikey, you know, when they were called upon to do their bit, they really, you know, they really put their hands up. And it is absolutely astonishing. So you do still get the modern resonance that there sometimes is a time when nations have to look after ourselves. You know, you can see with the recent announcements in the UK of increased defence spending, this is a very similar scenario to the 1930s. And, you know, if there are aggressive nations around, and we've obviously got a lot of authoritarian regimes who are making the world a less stable place, then you do need to defend yourself. And if that means devoting more money to defence than other things, then, you know, that's just how it's going to be if we want our lives to continue, you know, in the way they have been for since the Second World War, effectively.
Indeed. This book is called Sky Warriors, British Airborne Forces in the Second World War. It's by Saul David. I can say, Saul, can people find you on the, I mean, do you do anything social media wise? Can we find you on the internet?
Yeah, bits and pieces. I mean, my website, Saul David. .co.uk. I'm on Twitter. That's SaulDavid66, which give you a little clue of my age, actually. I mean, you know, I've been around now for quite a long time. Sky Warriors is my 20th book written in over a 30-year writing period. So,
congratulations.
Thanks so much. But anyway, great to chat to you about this. It's out today. So, you know, it's obviously front and center in my mind.
And the podcast, where can they find those? Well, give the name of the podcast again.
Yeah. So that's Battleground. We do two episodes a week, one covering what's happening in Ukraine and one, which is Second World War based. And we're covering the events of 1944. So very relevant to Sky Warriors. In fact, we had an episode on that recently, and we're going to be looking at D-Day and of course Arnhem. As we'll get Al on later on in the year. It'll be fun talking to him. As you say, he's got a book coming out, and he's focusing, interestingly, on a single day in Arnhem, you know, which he believes, of course, understandably, is the kind of hinge moment. I think it's the 19th he's chosen, which is absolutely true, because they hold out until the 19th. The following day, you know, it's all over. So it's going to be fascinating to see that.
Well, this is a fascinating book as well. The book is called Sky Warriors. It's by Saul David. Saul, thank you so much for joining me today.
Cheers. Thanks so much for having me on.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right here, right
now. It never happens at a good time. The pipe bursts at midnight. The heater quits on the coldest night. Suddenly, you're overwhelmed. That's when Home Service here. For $4.99 a month, you're never alone. Just call their 24/7 hotline and a local pro is on the way. Trusted by millions, Home Serve delivers peace of mind when you need it most. For plans starting at just $4.99 a month, go to homeserve.com. That's homeserve.com. Not available everywhere. Most plans range between $4.99 to $11.99 a month your first year. Terms apply on covered repairs.